Hey everybody, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt. I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our show where we review one good movie and one bad one. And the good movie this week is Orson Welles' The Stranger from 1946. And the bad one is, it's so bad I can't even remember it. It's
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back,
directed by Kevin Smith in 2001. And we're going to start with the good one. So, The Stranger, let's see, apparently Orson Welles regards it as one of his lesser movies. It's in public domain, so it's very easy to see. And I'd sort of heard of it because it was in public domain for a long time. And it stars Orson Welles. Its co-stars Edward G. Robinson. And you'd think it'd be more well-known, and especially because apparently it was also the only film directed by Welles at this time to sort of turn a profit. His movies like around that period, like Lady from Shanghai and The Magnificent Ambersons, didn't do well. And neither did Kane, really, at the time. Anyways, it's from Orson Welles' Hollywood period, basically. And even though it seems to have been like a B picture, even though it has Edward G. Robinson, It might have been a smaller budgeted film. I think it is because it has all this location shooting, but he's such a good director that he brings a bigness out of everything. There's a scene at the very end of the movie where a woman is on a 50-foot ladder, and apparently they just put her on a real 50-foot ladder. It's not a special effects shot. But this is kind of, I can see why Orson Welles feels kind of cold to this one, even if it did well, because it's a real Hollywood type picture for him. It's not really experimental. It's kind of the Shadow of a Doubt plot / The Stepfather. It's kind of like Orson Welles as The Stepfather because, it precedes Shadow of a Doubt, which is about someone evil hiding under the mask of normality in small town America. And the plot has Orson Welles as a Nazi, because this was 1946, a Nazi war criminal who never speaks even English in a German dialect or any German. But I'm sure Orson Welles knew some German, well-traveled person that he is. But I guess the point is, even though it's made in 46 and has him as a Nazi in the plot, that doesn't really factor into it. Fundamentally, it's just about him hiding his identity and not wanting to be discovered. Although it does have, it does use footage of the concentration camp, which apparently this film has the distinction of being the first American film to do so after the war was over. But it was just sort of a workmanlike, made thriller. And it's kind of, Welles is a fun actor to watch in anything, really. So I had a good time watching him as a villain, which he seems to relish playing the villains.
Yeah, some of the direction. I mean, he has a lot of crane shots here. It kind of reminds of what he's eventually going to do with Touch of Evil. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit before that, sort of a precursor to Touch of Evil, I guess, but. What I thought was so crazy about it is that, yeah, it's not one of his better known movies. It's in the public domain. And, it's gotta be from this period you have things, I wouldn't exactly say sympathetic Nazis, but by the 60s you did. The Great Escape was filled with sympathetic German characters. This is, I mean, they create, his character would have been high up in the Third Reich, and he is this entirely evil human being, and you're watching Orson Welles play him, and just like sort of, it's a movie star playing, I can't think of anything, it'd be like if, I don't know, Brad Pitt played Osama bin Laden or something. It's crazy, in a way. For the time it came out, that he would be doing this, and no wonder his career just totally bombed over and over again. Like, what a terrible idea. I mean, he's playing, he could...
Yeah, even though you have another big star, Edward G. Robinson, Robinson playing the good guy.
Right.
I mean, he kind of steals it from Edward G. Robinson, great as Edward G. Robinson is.
And now, he's not credited with the script, but there is some really nice... I guess he and John Huston worked on the script uncredited, and you can kind of see that in the dialogue with the guy who that the...
There's some really good lines.
Well, the thinking of the whole conversation with the guy in the town clerk when they play checkers. I mean, that's a very Wellesian type scene. And they also screw with the pace a bit. So you can tell that he changed the formula just enough to keep himself awake.
Well, according to IMDb, there were 20 minutes of additional footage with this character who gets murdered fairly early on in, who's playing an old Nazi comrade of Orson Welles. There's like 20 minutes of Constantine Shane, I believe, as Conrad Meinecke, got cut from the movie. So that's a big piece of pacing right there.
Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of... It'd be really long.
Yeah, I mean, the movie would have been 2 hours. I think it was 140, as it was, or 130. So, actually, I mean, he does die fairly early on in, so it would have given him more... I don't know. I can't say. It just would have been longer.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there would have, it would have taken longer for Wells to come into the movie.
Oh, that's right. Wells is, you start with Edward G. Robinson's character for a good bit at the beginning.
What's interesting about it is that there's never the moment where you think, like the serial killer movies with the big stars, where you don't think they're the serial killer for a second, and then it's supposed to be a surprise ending. You know right away from, you know, his first 15 seconds on screen that Wells is this Nazi bastard. And I mean, he kills this guy who tracked him down because this guy who tracked him down wants him to confess his sins and find God. And Wells is too busy hiding out, waiting for the Reich to rise again. And I
and that's kind of an interesting character detail, like, you know, that distinguishes him from this whole other former Nazi, that he does seem to seriously believe that the Germans are going to strike back and the war is going to continue. It's not developed afterwards. Because as far as Wells' character is concerned, the whole Nazi thing doesn't quite figure into his machinations of murder and hiding out in this small town. The Nazi thing does come back when Edward G. Robinson's character meets his wife, who kind of consists of the plot for Wells' character as he manipulates her. But... yeah, the Nazi thing doesn't quite figure into it, and they sort of dropped the idea that he thought that the Third Reich was going to rise again, which I was a little disappointed by. It was one of a few disappointments, because that's a very interesting, would have been an interesting way to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, the movie split sort of, okay, so if there'd been the 20 minutes, I guess you would have had a very long first act with this, whatever, him going through...
Constantine Shane, who might have like been cast by Wells, and that's why he gave him some huge subplot.
Right, and so then you have the initial scene, which is set on Wells and Loretta Young's wedding day, where he kills off his old Nazi buddy, and then you fast forward about a week to Edward G. Robinson investigating in town, and you miss all of his investigations when he is going through. He has this list where he crosses off the seven other possible people because no one knows what Wells' character looked like. The guy was, you know, did not like being seen. So he crosses that. We don't see any of that investigation. We don't even see when there are two people on the list and Wells' character is the second one, we don't even see the investigation into the guy above him. And then there's this sort of suggestion at one point that the two of them are working together on putting the clock back together. And that's never followed up on. It's just in dialogue. And it's so sparse that... it sort of gives the impression of being a much fuller script and story than, you know, if Welles just didn't like it and he just threw the pages out and didn't film the scene but kept the dialogue to...
Yeah. It has a sort of novelistic approach because it juggles the narrative between some characters and gives them each kind of their own point of view on what's happening. And they're, you know, it's, you know, divided only between Welles and Robinson and Loretta Young. And, you know, there isn't, like you said, there's not any suspense as to whether or not Welles is a Nazi bastard, but his wife goes through all this suspense, and there's a bit of suspense for what when you get when you're watching that, because, okay, Welles killed a former Nazi buddy, so it's not to be discovered, but is,
yeah,
you know what, I mean, he talks about, you know, Loretta Young's character is supposed to be the niece of a U.S. Supreme Court justice, so Welles is marrying up and into society, and, you know, maybe that's suggesting his access to the government later on, but you might think like that can't be the sole reason he wants to marry Loretta Young, but there kind of becomes a suspense in like how long he's going to put up with her and how long he's going to like he manipulates her into thinking that he's hiding out because he's a murderer, not because he's a Nazi war criminal murderer, but just a regular murderer, and he gets her to go along with it. And that's kind of where like the second side of the story comes along, and that's and it leads up to a climax of her in a bell tower, and it's pretty you know, it's kind of simple stuff but stylishly done, even all the way up to the rote death of the villain. Well, it's probably Welles' idea to have him impaled by the spoiler alert, rotating king figure of the town clock in the clock tower when they're up there at the end of the 50-foot ladder. It's pretty gruesome. It's so cool that they did it, because they're teasing it throughout the movie, because Robinson and Welles both are obsessed with clocks. Welles does work at the clock tower.
I think there's some implication that maybe in the cut scenes, Robinson was interested in clocks because of his obsession with Welles' character. And that was his only characteristic, mm-hmm. besides coming up with all the atrocities, was that he liked clocks. And I've seen it one time before, but I think I sort of just assumed that Robinson's interest was trying to figure out what Welles saw in the clocks as part of hunting him. The other thing I think is interesting is that, you know, while... sort of the classic, I guess, movies that people that are played a lot on TV and I guess kids are exposed to, I'm sure they're not anymore because Peter Jackson's going to remake everything in color so they never have to see black and white. The Stranger's got a lot of stones to it. I mean, it's not
balls.
It's got balls. It's got, I mean, it's rough in a lot of parts.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not shocking, but in the context of, say, a Marx Brothers movie, you know, this is very shocking. Kind of like how, what's the Gentleman's Agreement, which is the one with Gregory Peck, posing as a Jewish guy and finding out that there really is prejudice, even though all of his friends said there isn't or something. I think that's what it's called. Those are the types of movies that you don't really discover that, you know, it's not a... I'm trying to think of the blandest classic movie that... I mean, even Casablanca's got, you know, a lot of stuff to it. So I don't know why I always assumed that those movies didn't exist until I got AMC back when it was good, but I sure did.
And is The Stranger's not one of these movies, right? Because it's not on the, what was it? The Blockbuster Video 100 Movies of the Millennium or whatever.
Yeah, right. The, yeah, whoever did those lists. But I mean, there's that scene where they're sitting at the table and, Wells is going through his whole, you know, anti-German rant that is his prepared anti-German rant. And then there's this, and this is one of the one cheap moments in the movie, and I'll get to that in a second. But there's this scene where the guy's like, what are you talking about? Karl Marx, he was German. And Wells goes, no, he was a Jew. And I'm like, oh, well, that just gave him away. You know, that's when Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah. And then like one scene later, Edward G. Robinson realizes it in the middle of the night.
But he wakes up in bed right after Wells like kicks the dog or something and he yelps. And so he, oh yeah, Wells kills his wife's family dog and she forgives him. So, but anyway, because, you know, he was killing the dog to protect her. Her father,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the stepfather or something.
But there's this really terrible.
I don't think Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt did as much murdering to not get discovered.
No, because in Shadow of a Doubt, it's always questionable. I mean, until the end, there's always the chance he's not going to kill his niece. In this one, it's, you know, Wells killing Loretta Young is like, well, I've got to get rid of her at some point. I guess now instead of when, you know, the war starts up again.
But what's unique about it in this movie is that she discovers he is some kind of murderer. And, you know, in her crazy passion, she's just gotten married. She's going to stick it out with this guy who kills her dog.
Right, until her family dog.
Until he decides that she's like, oh, there's these great scenes of like her trying to lie to other people, and she can't do it. And then when they leave, she just breaks down.
Well, then there's the crazy scene where she realizes that he was going to kill her.
Yeah, and she it's kind of sitcom-ish.
I mean, she's just like, what?
She's just miffed about it.
But
hey. You're going to kill me. Ooh. Yeah. So,
I guess,
yeah, I liked Loretta Young's character is what I'm saying. I liked her kind of desperation and her pathetic desperation.
I think that the cut I'm talking about, the terrible cheap cut, some of the notes say that there was a lot of editing room conflict over it. So maybe that's why. That cheap, maybe Wells didn't do that. I mean, even bored, I can't see him doing that.
On this one, I'm not guessing.
But yeah, and besides Loretta, okay. So basically, the cast is it's not really the Mercury Theater.
No,
guys, but I mean, the cast is really obscure. Besides the three leads. Sorry. I didn't want to forget. There's also the implication that they are Quakers.
There is?
Well, the father always refers to her as sister.
I didn't notice.
The judge always refers to Loretta Young as sister, and I think that's I'm just going off of friendly persuasion, but I mean, is there some implication that they were Quakers?
Not that I caught. I mean, maybe there was that detail.
Yeah,
but it wasn't important.
But then, so Richard Long plays the brother of the character, the much younger brother. Well, not much younger than, but
oh yeah, yeah.
He's kind of an interesting Wells actor, and he was in Tomorrow Is Forever, which was one of Wells's. Big Hollywood melodramas that he did. But Wells did a good job directing these guys that I don't know how, you know, how much choice he had in getting them, but he really made them feel like Wells actors. And I liked his graying hair because you could just tell that he really enjoyed putting in his graying temples. But I think they must have also cut, like, the romantic interest between the doctor and Loretta Young, because it was sort of implied in the first scene they had together, but then it's totally ignored. But it's another one of the Wells movies where every, you know, missing piece of footage is totally destroyed and gone, so we'll never know.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't see it. It's one of his it's one of his good ones.
And it's it's fun, and it's a fun thriller.
It's like Lady from Shanghai. It's a genre film, as only he was doing them. So, yeah.
And now we're running into the problem of what happens when we talk about good movies. It does not run as long as when we talk about bad movies.
Well, let's see. What else about this film?
It was filmed on a set, and on a sound... that was a set. They built that town up as a set.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was amazed by that. It's a...
I know. Those are great sets. I thought it was location.
Yeah. It was... I think it said it was the United Artists backlot. I mean, that's really kind of... Because he does a lot of crane shots, to the point that the first shot of... They get to this town, and there's this really awkward chase scene, because it's like the Nazi...
It's like a student film chase scene between the old Nazi and Edward G. Robinson, yeah.
But it's when it starts... Oh, yeah, we can talk about the gym shots. But when it starts, there's this shot Edward G. Robinson crossing the street, and it's Wells doing a tracking shot from a crane, which is kind of cool, because I'm like, well, where'd he put the track? And then I realized it was a crane.
It's one of those really modern-looking shots that we've gotten used to in later movies, but not in old black and white ones.
And I'd say about maybe the first, especially that chase scene, is all very modern, to the point that it's very innovative Wells-type stuff in this otherwise pedestrian
what he would later expand on in Touch of Evil.
But this chase scene ends at the school, and it's totally unrelated at this point to the fact that Wells's character teaches at this school. But there's the scene where Robinson goes into the gymnasium, totally empty, dark gymnasium, and he gets conked on the head, whatever. But I think it's one of the first scenes that I can think of where the empty gymnasium is a ominous place. The big empty room is an ominous place.
Well, I think cat people had one.
Did they have one?
Yeah, I think they might have.
Okay, I can't remember.
But that was only 5 years earlier.
I know the remake did. So.
Oh, there you go.
But I was thinking that. Okay, so. Well, I mean, that's the other thing is Wells. Wells's influences.
Including Val Newton.
I mean, they would have been working at RKO at the same time, which is kind of... Begs the question. And, I mean, it's interesting because, Bogdanovich wrote... he has this...
Is Orson Welles.
This is Orson Welles, which is way too skinny of a book, but occasionally Welles talks about movies he likes in there. Mm-hmm. And directors he liked, sort of from this period, and he talks about movies a bit, and it's interesting because, you know, it's kind of like when you find out that Stanley Kubrick spent the last 10 years of his life watching Woody Allen movies, that's not what you would have expected, and Welles had some that were somewhat unexpected, but Bogdanovich sort of lost the point that Welles actually coexisted with these people that he was talking about and instead just had it sort of in the film history sense. So I don't know I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm not going anywhere with it. So do you want to cut it short and use the extra 5 minutes to talk about a real movie?
Yeah, I think we can do that.
Okay.
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was hilarious when I was 15. I don't understand what happened. I don't understand how my sensibilities could have changed so much since I was 15 and thought this was hilarious.
The same thing happened to me in Mallrats. The exact same thing. The last time I tried to watch Mallrats, I wanted to hang myself.
Because
one of the things is, and I don't know how when you're 15 or whatever, you don't realize this, Jason Lee is a terrible, terrible actor. I mean, he's atrocious.
He's better than Jason Mewes, though, who is just some guy Kevin Smith knew off the street and cast in his no-budget movie.
True, but he gives...
About 7 years later, he's starring in a movie with Kevin Smith himself.
See,
and that's the thing I was really aware of this time around that I wasn't aware of when I was 15, is that Kevin Smith wrote this movie to star in as himself. And this is the guy who later would write an episode of Degrassi, The Next Generation, where he gets to kiss the teenage character he's had a crush on all these years.
See... Yeah, okay, so my first Kevin Smith movie was Clerks, obviously. And I saw it on video right after it came out, and it was NC-17 or whatever and all that. And yeah, I still have like a good deal of respect for Clerks, and I even liked Clerks 2 and that sort of revisionist Rocky 6.
I hated Clerks 2, but I still have admiration for the original Clerks as well.
And it's like, I think that he got some goodwill off of that, that people kept, well, maybe, I don't know. Because it's like, I can't hate, I sat there and I watched Jason Mewes and I'm like, but he used him so well in the first Clerks. How did he, what happened?
Because he's in like two scenes in the first Clerks.
Exactly. What happened that he got this idea that he should turn him into this major character? It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the same thing that that has happened to Quentin Tarantino over the years has happened to Kevin Smith. It's not just because they were both discovered Miramax. It's that they had success at an early age, and their sort of life influences were more pop culture than real life. And then after they became rich and famous, they could never leave that bubble. And their movies have kind of devolved into self-obsessed pop culture fests in different ways. I mean, Quentin Tarantino has seen more movies than Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith has just read Marvel comics, I guess, is the main difference. But, like, yeah, Kevin Smith... Clerks has an authenticity to it because it's about... 20-something slackers, and Kevin Smith made it when he was a 20-something slacker. That's been his whole life experience. So he just kept copying the 20-something slacker thing, and like his last three movies since Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, which was supposed to be the end of the characters and the end of movies set in New Jersey and about 20-something slackers in New Jersey, which all of his films have in common. Even Dogma. I mean, Dogma pretty much starred the Jay and Silent Bob characters as sidekicks to the lead actress. But the three movies he's done since Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back have been Jersey Girl, Clerks 2, which was a breach of his promise not to go back to the well of these characters, and Zach and Miri Make a Porno, which stars Seth Rogen, and either maybe both proves that Seth Rogen isn't a star and he can't open a movie, or that Kevin Smith's complete lack, you know, insular lack of originality. I mean, made it as far as when they decide that their porno is going to be about Star Wars, and that's when I had to turn it off. But that movie didn't do well, and his next movie is a Bruce Willis buddy action comedy for a studio. So, he's not like Quentin Tarantino, where he might be able to make a good movie now and then on reserve talent. He is, he's genuinely untalented, but he happened to make a very authentic, movie and make it with, and that's his only movie with integrity, is Clerks, and everything else since then has just been, diminishing returns. His best days were, over after Clerks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with you about Clerks too, but
I just said nothing about the movie we're supposed to be talking about.
Well, that's why we have five extra minutes.
It's more like that's my opinion on Kevin Smith, so I'm glad.
That's why we have five extra minutes. I mean, you know, that's what we need. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and I didn't want to forget this. It's basically, I guess, you know, I was just reading the trivia real quick, and it was originally going to be about the two characters in New Jersey saving the Quick Stop, which sounds like a smaller scale movie, more appropriate for what Kevin Smith does. What I love about this is he shoots at Panavision. You know, like Dogma was ugly enough, and now we've got this. But anyway, so.
Well, that's funny because the crazy credits, and there are a lot of crazy credits. Oh boy, this movie's just, you know, nutty. One of the crazy credits thanks Bob, who I think is Bob Weinstein, for the idea of taking them, who said, he's credited thanks for saying take them out of New Jersey, or get them out of New Jersey. So I guess the Weinsteins let him shoot at Panavision if he had a BJ and Silent Bob go to Hollywood and rip off the last act of Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Exactly. It's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, only it's sort of this... It's incredible that Kevin Smith got to make, that he was this popular at some point, because he's not popular anymore. Like, he's,
yeah, no,
you know,
kidding.
Jersey Girl bombed. He had to beg people to go see Jersey Girl or something. Like, he was going to stand outside the theater and personally refund money if people didn't like it. That was going to be his big breakthrough. And then he tried to return to this with Clerks 2, but didn't like
not even Rosario Dawson could do it for him.
And then what, the Zach and Mary,
he was like, and then he was like, who else is popular on Ain't It Cool News? Oh, I know, Seth Rogen.
And then yeah, that didn't work out. And so wow, Cop Out's coming out from Warner Brothers. He's actually directing a movie for Warner Brothers. That's hilarious. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, and this movie is just filled with these inane, terrible scenes. Shit. Okay, I didn't mean to watch the preview. I was trying to find the new poster. Anyway, there's this the Ben Affleck thing. I mentioned that to you before. He plays like six roles in this movie, and he's terrible in each one of them.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, he's just awful. And it's like, you know that he can't think he was doing a good job, right? So why?
The movie was, look, you're right about it being made sort of near the peak of his Kevin Smith's popularity. Because this is when he had a Clerks cartoon on ABC, however, you know, few episodes it actually aired. But, you know, he had a Clerks tune on ABC. And this is like the same year, I think, as Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. At the time, it was all right because, like, I was in his target audience, a 15-year-old Kevin Smith fan. And this movie is just a celebration of all that bullshit. It's got cameos by every single character he's created in the previous four movies that he had directed, except for Dogma, because I guess none of those would fit. But Carlin is back, like he was in Dogma. And it's just a dumbass celebration of Kevin Smith by Kevin Smith, starring Kevin Smith. And as a member of the target audience, I loved it. So I didn't mind that Ben Affleck was playing all these different versions of himself, because he was returning as the characters. I mean, that's who it appealed to at the time, and it's sort of impossible to imagine this appealing to somebody who had never seen a previous Kevin Smith movie. I mean, if they saw it today, it's sort of a one-time. It's really a movie in a time capsule, put it that way. Although it does have Will Ferrell.
It does. It before Will Ferrell was a big deal, it has Will Ferrell in it, which I found very interesting. Because he's really not funny at all. I mean, he's painfully unfunny. I don't dislike Will Ferrell. I mean, I think he's, whatever. This is just like, wow. There's the Judd Nelson cameo where there's rednecks or something.
There's a shit ton of cameos by, again, Ain't It Cool News people. I mean, I like how Mark Hamill is in it, and the movie does an on-screen title to announce him, but they don't do that for Carrie Fisher, who was in the movie earlier.
Right. Well, that's because Carrie Fisher's not playing Carrie Fisher. Carrie Fisher's playing the nun.
Right, and Mark Hamill is doing the Joker voice from the Batman cartoon.
And this is like the really odd period of Miramax movies, because they actually do have. I mean, they're somewhat aware. I mean, somehow they managed to be somewhat aware of the fact that Miramax recycled their entire cast over and over again. Their casting in the late 90s over and over, mid to late 90s. But they don't make it funny somehow, even though they comment on it.
Well, yeah, it's because, yeah, Kevin Smith is, you know, oh man, he's ripping on Miramax in this movie so hard, you know.
And I mean, there's,
like, he's actually going to bite the hand that feeds him.
There's this thing where they
Ben Affleck and Matt Damon play themselves, and they do a spoof of Good Will Hunting, and it's like, this is like Scary Movie caliber stuff, basically.
And then, well, the thing about how they keep on, everybody's favorite Ben Affleck movie is Phantoms. That made me
laugh when I was 15, because it was like, oh yeah, Phantoms.
Well, it's even more amusing because I just remember how awful Phantoms is, but I remember at the end when they missed the punchline of that, like they missed the final punchline possibility where, I don't know, because Ben Affleck and Matt Damon have this whole bickering thing where they they're like filming their scene and bickering about something, and they're making fun of each other's film choices.
Right.
And the thing is that this is pre-Born Identity Matt Damon, so it's before he was, you know, the big action hero that he is now.
Yeah. And you know what, watching a bunch of actors playing themselves to make fun of themselves is something I hate in movies, because no actor ever makes fun of themselves well. I mean, I guess the only place that's ever worked has been the Larry Sanders Show, but
I think Bruce Willis did a good job in Ocean's 12.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
Okay, because he wasn't really making fun of himself. There was this whole Julia Roberts thing. But anyway, I think there's a little bit of difference between Soderbergh and Kevin Smith. But
it's pretty lame in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And I don't know. It's like what?
Wait, I thought of the good actors.
A good actress?
The good actors in the movie.
Oh, the good actors.
The guys from Clerks were both good at the beginning.
That's the thing, yeah.
They have, like, this really little scene.
At the time, it was like, oh, one more little scene of Dante and Randall, those characters from Clerks. Little did we know that, you know, the Dogma character is Alanis Morissette playing God. She shows up after the credits and closes a book entitled The View Askewniverse, because that's what...
Are you serious? I missed that.
Oh, you did stay through the credits? Man, they were hilarious.
Oh, my God. Okay, the Purple Rain thing was kind of funny. I mean, that was cool that they got What's-His-Face back, but it's not enough to sit through this crap. I mean, that was kind of the thing is, it's like...
You know what else, But you know who else was funny, but not good enough to sit through the crap? Chris Rock. His character was pretty damn funny.
That
actually
was pretty good. Yeah. I mean, what's the line about?
Nobody plays an angry black militant more hilariously than Chris Rock.
What is it? The guy, Jamie Kennedy, went to film school, and you know, does his dad know this is what he does with his life? That was good. But the whole female criminal lesbian team. I didn't know they were supposed to be lesbians until I read the trivia, because before that they just they jumped the pizza delivery guy in the movie. So that really seemed kind of, I realized Kevin Smith thought it was probably empowering because they were all in leather or something, but that seemed really Shane Black-ish to me.
Well, it's not even Shane Black, it's like Scary Movie. It's like, you know, this is like a dumb cliche of like, you know, Charlie's Angels type slow motion rubbing their bodies in all leather outfits and they're international jewel thieves. It's like the same well of pop culture filth that we all drink from now because Family Guy is on the air like 16 hours a day. And Kevin Smith, I'll give, you know, Kevin Smith was kind of ahead of his time for a little while. And, I think in 2001, like, Family Guy hadn't been on very long, and it was kind of at the beginning of the whole pop culture regurgitation thing that defined the 2000s, for me, anyway. And Kevin Smith was kind of doing that before it was hip, like, the Scooby-Doo parody, which is now kind of an obligatory pop culture, you mark it off your checklist if you're doing a pop culture potpourri movie, like Scary Movie, or the, you know, date movie, disaster movie, any of those, which make a lot of money.
Apparently, the Daredevil thing was a big deal at the time too. I missed that, but it is kind of amusing to see that James Vanderbeek at one point was like supposed to be a movie star.
Even Jason Biggs.
Poor Jason Biggs. I mean, so the characters don't know that there's an internet, which I guess is possible in 2001, right? I mean,
well, I remember at the time it was funny, like, who hasn't heard of the internet?
Right, but still, I mean, the internet had only been...
We didn't even talk about the fact that the reason Jay and Silent Bob are going on a cross-country Pee-wee's Big Adventure road trip to Hollywood is because they're pissed off by what people are writing about them online. And Kevin Smith, like, built his fan base online from, like, Ain't It Cool News types. So this is, like, his movie that's expressing this weird, like, masochistic hatred that he has of his own fans.
And then end does have this scene where they tour the country with their movie winnings to beat up little 13-year-old boys who talk crap about them.
That's the audience.
And it just seemed, at that point, it just seemed like, it's like he doesn't know how to tell a joke, which is how I felt watching Mallrats the last time I tried to, is that he doesn't actually know how to tell. I mean, because that's funny. Beating up a 13-year-old boy should be funny. You know, going to his house in suburbia and dragging him out, and these, you know, drug dealers dragging him out on the street and beating him up. That should get a giggle. But I was just kind of like, you know, it doesn't work with your overstyle, with your bad Panavision. I mean,
it's like, it'd be funny if this movie took place in real life, like the first to some kind of degree, but you know, it's sort of the point is that, like, by his second movie, Mallrats, he's got Jay and Silent Bob spouting catchphrases as they as Kevin Smith gets to fly around like Batman.
But
Batman.
But
so,
where I was
yeah.
they didn't know who was starring in the movie. They couldn't find that information online. And I'm like, what audience are you making this for where anyone would believe that a movie starts shooting in 3 days and nobody knows who's playing the leads?
Well, but it's not. It's a live-action cartoon. They run into the Scooby-Doo gang. Like, that's the point.
Whatever.
Oh, really? I mean, that kind of... even. I mean...
Okay, but James Vanderbeek.
You could argue that Mallrats could take place in real life, but by the time he did Dogma, he had.
The thing is, did he really think James Vanderbeek and Jason Biggs were a payoff? I mean, if it had been Pacino and De Niro playing Jay and Silent Bob, that would have been some kind of a payoff. If it had been, I don't know, Sean Connery, and if it had been Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, that would have been hilarious.
Instead, it's
some lame little. I mean, you know, I even like Jason Biggs, and I'm saying it's a lame ass cameo. And then all the gay jokes that he says were in there to intentionally offend people.
And well, kinda, this movie got protested by GLAAD.
It's like, were they in there to offend people, or were they in there so you didn't have to write five more minutes of material? And it's like really long, right? It's like 2 hours or something. I mean, this is, it's 104 minutes. I mean, this is just such an unpleasant experience.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was really a time capsule. I mean, people will look back at this and go, oh, yeah, Steve Kometko used to be on the E! Channel, and that's what the E! Channel used to look like when the E! Channel would promote upcoming movies. And Jon Stewart is a fake news anchor. That's pretty...
Before the Daily. I mean, I think Jon Stewart was in this.
No, it was like
it?
When he...
Okay.
Yeah, he had been on the air for a few years.
Okay.
It's been a long time now.
Because
people look back and say, oh, that's very 2000s, Jon Stewart.
Okay. And Ben Affleck getting major roles, I mean, before...
Mm-hmm.
This is before Jennifer Lopez, I believe. Yeah, so...
Before Jennifer Lopez killed Kevin Smith's career.
It's all her fault. Didn't he try blaming that on her?
Yeah. He was like, oh, people heard that this is a Ben Affleck, Jennifer Lopez movie. That's why they didn't go see it, because Gigli just came out and bombed.
Okay, let me see if there's anything. I said something nice. Chris Rock, and I said...
Oh, no, we've said some nice things, for sure.
Yeah. The girls in it... I mean, Shannon Elizabeth was okay, but, I mean, the performances from Eliza Dushku and Ellie Larder were some of the worst acting I've ever seen in a Panavision movie. And that includes a dubbed, you know, Italian movie that's been dubbed six times over. You know, slasher picture from...
I think Kevin Smith has a problem directing pretty girls. And that's why some of his better movies are about Dante and Randall having long dialogue scenes. Remember how people used to say Kevin Smith was really good at dialogue?
They didn't say that at this point, though. They couldn't have.
No.
Oh, and
Dogma had to be the end of that, I guess.
Okay, so then I do remember this from my period of Kevin Smith fandom. He did a comic book of Jay and Silent Bob that was a prequel to Dogma, and it has the big ape monologue that Jay has.
Oh yeah, it has the same.
It has the exact same monologue, only in the other one, in the comic book, it ends with them putting the head on the Lincoln Monument, and then in this one, it's just the ending from Planet of the Apes, and famously, Tim Burton said that no, he didn't get that from Kevin Smith. He would never read anything Kevin Smith wrote. And Kevin Smith at one point was supposed to be writing the script for Tim Burton's Superman Returns that didn't happen. And so everybody was like, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't even make that into an issue here. There could have been a joke about it. You know, I mean, they could have broken the fourth wall and said, hey, Tim Burton, you going to steal that too? Something. Instead, it's just, and it's like the target audience has read the comic book and bought the limited edition hardcover that, you know, Kevin Smith drooled on for them. So it's just kind of like you're not rewarding people.
No. I mean, that's what I meant about this movie being about how Kevin Smith hates his audience, because he treats the audience for this movie, which is such a specific audience, and he knows it, with a lot of contempt and with a lot of, you know, he doesn't go for the Tim Burton joke. He repeats the joke of characters breaking the fourth wall and looking at the camera. Like, I thought it was like, I remember when I was 15 knowing that it was not cool to have Silent Bob talk a second time, that ruined the first one, the first time he talks retroactively. And I knew that having the characters repeat the look at the camera gag, like, you should probably only break the fourth wall once, and at a really funny moment, you shouldn't keep doing it. Even then, I knew that, stood out. but I'd only remembered the characters looking at the camera twice, and I think they do it like five times total.
Yeah, and I mean, he has written since this some funny stuff. The flying car gag is funny, and that's like basically just a long joke. I don't know. Like I said, Clerks 2, I dug it, whatever. So it's kind of, I don't know what the hell.
Did you like when Kevin Smith rotated the camera around Dante and Randall as they were arguing? Was that some good cinematography?
I don't remember that, but I did love the. I did
branching out as a director.
I did love the musical thing. So there, that when they break out into song and dance, I loved that. And the scene with Wanda Sykes, I mean, that you know, come on.
Well, it was better than Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
There you go. And there weren't, even though Rosario Dawson was in Clerks 2, and now we're just totally just going to talk about Kevin Smith because we get 10 minutes and I can't think of anything else to say about the stupid movie except it was so unpleasant. I mean, it was just like, it was just, and had Scream 3 already come out? Did Scream 3 really not?
Yeah, Scream 3 was like 2000.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were people out there who weren't enraged by how.
And there is a Scream gag, but it's, you know, he's not, Kevin Smith just doesn't care. He's not trying. It's just like Jay and Silent Bob stick their heads into a Scream movie.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing is it's Jay and Silent Bob running through Miramax into like a handful of Miramax productions, and not even. I mean, they run through Good Will Hunting 2, which doesn't make any narrative sense, would be my complaint of it. Like, it's not a funny joke because them turning into like serial killers or something isn't. I mean, that's whatever.
It's like a Family Guy gag. It's just as gratuitous and mean-spirited and,
well, yeah,
as if Family Guy did, as Kevin Smith did, Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season.
The difference is Family Guy does it in 15-second spurts without setup. And in this, we go through the whole thing about, are they filming Good Will Hunting 2, or are they filming Jay and Silent Bob, and then there's, what are Jay and Silent Bob going to do in the background? Oh, nothing. So what was the point of that? The whole joke of them in the background was to walk off screen or something, and it's like...
The joke was to have them present so that, you know, Kevin Smith have the scene be about Ben Affleck and Matt Damon.
And then the fat jokes, which are...
more awkward than I remembered. Like, I remember my friend... who used to have kind of a weight problem, but he's thin now, so I can say that he had kind of a weight problem then. he really laughed at Jay's line when Kevin Smith can't fit through that pipe.
Yeah.
You know, you fat ass. I mean, that kind of laugh. So, but it doesn't, yeah, Kevin Smith could definitely fit through that pipe, though. So it's kind of awkward.
Uh-huh.
Kind of an awkward joke now. Kevin Smith is... I'm sure fatter today than he was in 2001.
Well, okay, I'm looking through the cast, and I guess, like, the pizza delivery guy who Eliza Dushku... The ugly-looking pizza delivery guy who Eliza Dushku proves her feminism by sexually exploiting him. Pizza delivery guy is played by Joe Quesada, who's the Marvel Comics guy who hired Kevin Smith to write comics. And then Paul Dini, who does did the Batman cartoons in it for a second. And so, he did the Batman cartoon.
No, who was he in?
He was the camera loader. I mean, that's how lame some of these cameos are. I mean, you gotta look, the camera loader. Yeah. Oh, that guy. I mean, it's like if, all they ever talked about in RoboCop was how Kurtwood Smith's wife played the secretary. That's how big these roles are.
Do you think Kevin Smith, how come he passed up the opportunity to take a dig at Tim Burton in the Planet of the Apes scene, but not, but he had no problem stealing the fake backlot gag from Pee Wee's Big Adventure wholesale?
What if he'd at least commented on it? I mean, then it would have been funny. Yeah. I mean,
look, they even steal a bicycle. That's how much of a Pee Wee ripoff it is. So why not just have them knock Pee Wee Herman off his bicycle and steal it?
Pee Wee Herman would have done it. But, I mean, yeah, because they would have had to set up two jokes. And I don't think, are there any jokes that run that long in this? They would have had to set up the initial Tim Burton joke after Jay's rant about the Planet of the Apes happening. And then when they get to the back lot, there'd have to be some knowing joke reference to ripping off a Tim Burton movie and not crediting him or something. And then maybe being like,
no, that's not it. Yeah.
Wait, I just thought of it. It'd be hilarious if they'd been like, didn't this happen in Pee-wee's Big Adventure? And Jay says, you know, I don't watch Tim Burton movies. Something like that. That would have been perfect.
It would have been awesome.
See?
Maybe that just never enters into Kevin Smith's head because he's too busy getting to the next Star Wars reference, like having Chris Rock yell George Lucas is going to sue somebody because he's got lightsabers in because he has Mark Hamill wield a lightsaber. Oh, and gets his hand cut off and says, not again. Isn't that funny, kids?
That seems really stupid because, the whole, way they're making the movie, that really just bugged me. I was just like, who's this for? Like, come on, 11-year-olds aren't this dumb. Right? Like, it's... Right.
Anyway. It's like... Well, maybe again, 11... live-action cartoon. Jay puts on the blunt costume, and he steps into the scene with a costume to Mark Hamill, and suddenly it's like the movie is real, and Mark Hamill is doing the scene, and he is his character. There's no distinction between Mark Hamill's character as an actor playing a villain and just the appearance of a villain played by Mark Hamill, and that's who the character is.
Now, that scene where, what's his face? Tracy Morgan shows up playing the Black Jay, and he has a Silent Bob sidekick who doesn't talk, and it's...
Oh, yeah, that was a brief breath of air.
Yeah, it was a West Coast, East Coast drug dealers, local meeting, etc., etc. They should have spun that into a 15-minute segment, because that was a lot better than the whole more gay jokes with the security guard at the studio.
They seemed, although I admit the line, oh, what a lovely tea party, does still make me kind of crack a smirk. But Tracy Morgan's drug dealer character at least seemed like a drug dealer, whereas Jay and Silent Bob, while they're supposed to be drug dealers, even smoking weed doesn't even figure into this movie for a movie that has Because I Got High in the credits. You watch a Cheech and Chong movie and they're token left and right, but for a couple of weed smoke, I'm pretty sure Jay used to yell about weed, at least yell about it more in the previous movies, but maybe because 11-year-olds might be going to see this movie, they're not, they pull out the weed like twice, even though they're supposed to be dealers. It's not a pot culture movie, and Kevin Smith isn't even, well, I don't know, Kevin Smith just kind of, exploits that book very superficially. It's really more about, like, I would describe Jay and Silent Bob in this movie as more Star Wars fans than I would, druggies, even though, like, well, shouldn't that be like part of why Jay is so stupid?
I think at this point,
instead he's just, he's not, in this one, he's not stupid because he's stoned all the time. He's just stupid.
I think at this point, what's-his-face's drug problems had become really problematic.
Oh, that's right. That's yeah. that's the reason. Yeah. Real life Jason Mewes had to go to a methadone clinic a couple of years later or something.
Yeah, so maybe it just wasn't as funny. I don't know. But if there weren't an internet, how would anybody understand this in this day and age? I mean, really? Like, you know...
This movie, if I had to recommend this movie, I would recommend it to people who spend a lot of time on the internet.
But that's kind of even anymore, would you? Because it's so dated in terms of the internet.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, go back to the internet in 2001.
I mean, yeah. So
it's one of these movies that, you know, it's like the same problem of all the superhero movies. It's like the development process and test marketing happens on the internet, and it did for this movie.
Yeah.
That's time.
So Jason Mewes is trying to breach out, okay. Or branch out.
As an actor?
I guess. I mean, his profile shot on IMDb does not have him looking... I mean, one of them has him looking like an idiot, but he just looks like... He actually looks like freaking Christian Bale in this one. Maybe if Christian Bale bails out of Batman 3, they'll put Jason Mewes in it. It'd be hilarious. Whatever. Jason Lee sucks. What else do I want to recap?
I remember being kind of excited about... This is right where Kevin Smith's career crashed and burned for me, because it was right before he did Jersey Girl. There was a possibility that he might... write a Fletch sequel with Jason Lee.
Yes.
And I could have saved his career looking back, but he wasn't willing to. He was even supposed to write the Green Hornet movie that Seth Rogen is now going to star in, but he backed out of that too. It's like he keeps almost writing these genre movies, like he almost got to write a Superman movie, which I don't know, I haven't read it, but for all I know, he could have, you know, been okay at being a genre movie writer rather than someone trying to make movies that have,
now his, I mean,
have some kind of direct, well, whatever, I guess if he's directing, you know, a Bruce Willis, Tracy Morgan, buddy cop movie, he's going to be more of a workman in the future, perhaps.
The Green Hornet script is, he turned it into a comic, so I guess... It's coming out in a few months. I guess that'll be the first chance to see, I don't know, how he would do as a genre writer. Because I can't remember his Daredevil comics.
Wait a minute, I just remembered I read a Spider-Man comic that he wrote.
Yeah.
Where Spider-Man, where... close friends and second bananas are getting killed off, and then at the end you find out who's responsible and it's Mysterio.
No, that's Daredevil. That was the Daredevil one.
Oh, okay, it's Daredevil. And Mysterio, and I only read this because Kevin Smith wrote it and I picked it up. And Mysterio complains about how he was always a, like, neglected villain, and that's why he's taking his revenge now. It's like Kevin Smith's basically saying that he likes this villain, and
yeah,
pretty incompetent is what I'm saying. So maybe he couldn't do genre stuff well either.
But
hell, he could have been able to write a Fletch movie, I presume. He was doing interviews saying like, yeah, it's going to be much more like the novel than I've read the novels, and it's going to be different from a Chevy Chase movie.
Yeah, and then he got into a whole spat with Chevy Chase about it and all sorts of other stuff. And then he didn't even do it. Now the Fletch movies are dead. Again, because of the Weinstein Company split, I think. Because that was the big deal, was Miramax was trying to start that as a comedy franchise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Of course, I mean, this is just like what he was supposed to make. Doesn't Dogma end with coming soon, The Passion of the Clerks?
Yeah, it does.
Or something. Or coming soon. No, it was coming soon, Clerks 2, still clerking. And then when he announced Clerks 2, he said it was going to be called The Passion of the Clerks. And everybody's like, you mean like The Passion of the Christ? And he's like, I've never heard of that movie. What are you talking about? And it's like, that's wait, crazy. You've never heard of the third highest grossing movie of all time? Okay. You know, it's just like...
He said he had The Passion of the Clerks in mind as a title before The Passion of the Christ came out.
And then you see Clerks 2, and that wouldn't have worked at all because it's really just... You know, it's him actually doing the bromance instead of doing the chicks again.
It's him doing the Judd Apatow.
Yeah, it's the we're growing up thing, yeah.
Yeah, Judd Apatow was sort of able to do the movies that Kevin Smith
can't do.
Can't do. And never will be able to do because Judd Apatow actually seems to have had some life experience before. Having his first successful movie. He didn't just come out of nowhere.
And I mean, I think that, and we're running over a little, but I think some of Kevin Smith's, the fan, not popularity, but the endearment he had through the 90s had to do with him actually doing good audio commentaries, like informative audio commentaries. I don't know what they're like after Chasing Amy, because I only have heard Clerks and Chasing Amy, but... They were actually informative, you know, how you make a low-budget movie, this, that, and the other thing. And so, as opposed to it just being idiotic Kevin Smith stuff, it was closer to, say, a John Carpenter and Deborah Hill commentary than it was to what I'm sure commentaries are like now. It was actually a technical commentary, which was very interesting.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. He was doing he did Laserdisc commentaries back even before DVDs.
So. Yeah. So, okay. So
that's enough ragging on Kevin Smith, I guess.
That movie sucked, but anyway, moving on.
That movie's quite possibly his worst movie, although I haven't seen Jersey Girl. So, next week, we've got Martin Scorsese's classic Mean Streets as our good movie. And for a bad movie, a Dolph Lundgren and Brandon Lee actioner showdown in Little Tokyo. From 1991, one of the eclipsing years of the buddy action genre.
And I believe Showdown in Little Tokyo, yes it did, it came out in the theater. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's directed by Mark Lester, director of Class of 1984 and Commando. So,
and
you know.
And Tia Carrere's in it before Wayne's World, and yeah.
Oh, wow. I think she's like a Babasaurus Rex in Wayne's World parlance.
Anyway.
That's next week. Check out alansmithpodcast.info for information about previous episodes. And leave some comments on iTunes. Wish. This is an Alan Smithy podcast. I've been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.